On Sunday, April 20th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl concludes its celebration of International Poetry and Jazz Appreciation Month with a look at New York-born Puerto Rican award-winning poet, playwright, teacher, and activist, Jesus Papaleto Melendez. That's Sunday, April 20th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Away. I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. So funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl, I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
That's right, you are listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is Jesus Papaleto Melendez. Papo! Yeah, I understand he's even listening right now, so yay. Welcome to Sugar in My Bowl, everybody. You will enjoy this final celebration from us for Jazz Appreciation and National Poetry Month. It's been an adventure, and I hope you've learned a lot, because I know I have. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Ooh, thank goodness we are here. Stay tuned for, what's this show again? What is it? Come on, you can tell me. Speak up.
I want some sugar in my bowl.
la tribu ya se enfogona.
Hi, everybody. My name's Joyce Jones. I'm here with my co-hosts, Hank Williams and Jesus Papalito Melende. Thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Oh, okay. You're welcome. She got his sugar in my bowl. Very good.
Why don't you tell us? You know, I've heard that you were born in El Barrio, East Harlem, and then you moved to the Bronx.
Yeah. You know, any question you ask me, I've had like this life. Okay. Yeah, I'm from El Barrio. I'm from East Harlem, but I wasn't born there. And, you know, like I've tried to investigate this since I was so young. I had eyewitnesses. But we were living in El Barrio, but I was born in Long Island City, just on the other side of El Barrio. Long Island City sounds exotic, but it's just on the other side of the East River. Well, I mean, you could throw a rock from El Barrio over there.
Particularly at that time, it probably wasn't very exotic.
I was born in Long Island City, or Queens, because it says Queens, New York on my thingamajig.
First certificate.
But we were living in El Barrio, and I think we lived on the sixth floor, and then we moved to the fifth floor, which is the apartment that I remember in my youth. And that was on 11th Street in East Harlem. And we lived there till I was about 14, mid-60s. I was just going into my teenage thing, being awareness. And we moved to what was the South Bronx then. And there was hardly, you know, anybody. There was all Italian. In fact, we were the first Puerto Rican family in our building and practically on our block, which was on Morris Avenue, across from Melrose Projects. And then there were a lot of illustrious Puerto Ricans come out of Melrose Projects.
I heard that you grew up around a lot of black folk or African Americans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially in East Harlem. And that was very crucial in my whole makeup, the whole maturation of who became Papaleto. Let me elaborate on that. Well, we lived in a tenement on 11th Street, and when I was a kid, there was a lot of music, live music and jazz music, and the Latin music that came out, there were records, but it was old-time records, but there was a lot of live Latin music out in the street. Machito lived up the block. My street is named after Machito. He and his sister, Graciela, lived over there by the firehouse, and there were other musicians scattered around. My dad was a musician. He played slide trombone and trumpet in Puerto Rico. Is that what he did for a living? He should have. Well, you know, my dad was a merchant marine, and the transition of Puerto Ricans coming from the island to here as men, grown men, coming into society was different than bringing your children, even though they had their own experience. You know what I'm saying? It's where you were at. And so, you know, one of the hardships was that men had a hard time finding work when they came here. And the women became the workforce, working the factories, you know, doing all the thing, jewelry, making dolls and clothing and stuff like that. And very few men got jobs in the factory. Maybe one or two Puerto Ricans, the janitor or whatever. You know what I mean? There's a whole sociocultural thing we can get into about that. But that's the reality I remember, you know, as a kid. So, you know, my dad had a hard time. He got involved with drugs, which were very prevalent then, which was the downfall of a lot of people. And I write about it all the time because it was intense in my life that, you know, my dad's life or the lack of it in my life was so intense that I have to write about it as a writer, you know, because it tells people something about us. It's our experience here, not us as a who we are, but what happened to us being here.
I always thought that I knew all the answers, answers in the book. Without a second look, I always felt that I knew where the kicks were, chicks were in this town and everywhere around. I didn't ever have a single blue thought, new thought in my head. Outside of wine and bread, I surely didn't want to love to send me, bend me up and down, and twist me all around. But then I met you. What I can do, 'cause you made me doubt, turned me inside out, made me work each day, bring home all my pay, made me slow my pace, really stay on base, made me settle down, took me off the town. No more whining kicks. No more fancy chicks. But I played your game. Didn't find it tame. Till one day I found things had turned around. You're the one who got the really wing and swinging with the guys. Now I'm sad and wise, and now I know that you had all the answers, answers in that book, and I was really took. Here I am at home without a penny and no place to go. Yet I love you so. I'll even try to write if mail can reach you, teach you that I'm cool and I'm not still a fool. So that is why I tell this tale to woo you, to you while you're home. I send this letter from home.
You know, like when I walked out into the hallway as a little kid, you know, I didn't even know how old I was or self-aware. But, you know, you bump into your neighbors and their kids. And, you know, they see everybody notices everybody. And so my awareness was my building was like, you know, a little mini United Nation, but it was mostly black and Puerto Rican. And the black experience was different for me, even though there are black Puerto Ricans. You see, so, and maybe that's probably where the confusion is. Like, these guys, they're black like black Puerto Ricans, but they don't speak Spanish. So, you see, people really have to try to understand. You have to put yourself back in the 50s. You almost have to think in black and white. And so there were a lot of culture clashes, which still continue now, you know. But
well, I understood even for you that speaking Spanish wasn't exactly something that you were fluent in.
No. My mother would talk to me in Spanish, and my father, and blah, but I somehow English was, I find, more native to myself, even though Spanish is innate. That would be the best way. One's innate and the other is native. And I grasped English very quickly. So when I stepped out into the hallway and I met my African friends, Snooky, Wilbur, Benjamin, Ricky, Brinson, some name like that that I kind of remember. But Snooky and Wilbur, they were my good friends. And we were always hanging out. And, well, Snooky and I became friends by getting into a fight with each other that lasted all day in the hallway. It was like two dinosaurs scrolling down some bush, you know. And it was because he wouldn't let me go down the stairs, you know, and I wanted to go down the stairs and he wouldn't let me. So then, you know, I got into a fight. And it was a ridiculous fight. It lasted forever. But that's how we became friends. And he introduced me to everybody and, you know, their sisters and their family. And I write about them in Hey Yo, Yo Soy, in some of those books. There's some quotes, living in the love of the ghetto people and stuff like poems like that that I wrote about.
So the music.
Yeah, I remember Brubeck. You know, Take Five was out then, and it was a new album then. You know, it wasn't like, you know, like now, oh yeah, I got Take Five. No, it was new. Sarah Vaughan and everybody. The good thing about hanging out with African Americans, though, in those days, of course, we were all colored. I always tell people that we were colored then, was that they introduced me to English from a mainline perspective. You know, like, it was like
by a mainline perspective.
Because, okay, Puerto Ricans came here not knowing English. So there's no mainline connection, you see what I mean? You got to figure it out. But then when you have black friends who have a whole history of English and you're rapping with them on a daily basis, you're quickly learning things. You know, you're learning regular English and hip talk too. And making those cross references, like it's a synaptic thing that's going on, especially in your formative brain, which I know affects how I speak and how I think and, you know, how I inflect that. Also with my dad being a musician, you know, and stuff like that. So that's cool.
How did the music affect your presentation of poetry? Or writing in general, I guess.
Well, you know, the thing about it is that I guess since I'm a Latino, rhythm is important in expression. Like when I lived in Mexico, you know, people say, oh, Mexicans always sound like they're singing when they're talking. You know what I mean? Well, they do to the ear that doesn't understand Spanish. Or sometimes people say, oh, Spanish people talk real fast. You know what I mean? Well, you know, if you're not used to Japanese, you think Japanese people talk real fast. You know what I mean? But people do speak at different speeds. But I think everybody speaks within their culture so that everybody understands it. Like when you're angry, then a conversation is real fast, you know, if you look at it on the graph and everything like that. I think that being Latino, there was a melodic sense to my expression, so that when I began to write, there was a rhythm in the writing naturally, which is how poems come to me, you know. They come, there'll be a line, and it has a particular rhythm. That's why all my poems don't sound the same. Well, like when I was in San Francisco being lonely and hungry and homeless, I was walking down the street. To me, today, these walls are new. You know, that's different than, hey, you, Sicile from small town nowhere, U.S. of A. And faster than a roach running from a spray can. That's a super pig, you know? You know, and then there's wind, blow wind, go on. The poems come in their own rhythm. That's why I keep trying to tell young people, and they don't want to listen to me because I'm old. But I said, nah, you know, all poems can't all sound the same, you know? I grew up rhythmically thinking or feeling and blah, blah, blah. Now, I couldn't really express myself when I was younger. So if you look at Hey Yo, you will see the book, Hey Yo, you will see that it's three books compiled into one. The first one is Casting Long Shadows, then Have You Seen Liberation, and then Street Poetry and Other Poems. And they're three books that I published all before 1972. So we put them all together into one book, and that wasn't enough. So what we did was we put two extra chapters, like a prologue chapter and an epilogue chapter, each consisting of one poem. And those are two new poems, Hey Yo being a new poem that was not written in that era. In fact, we could say it was written 40 years later from that era. And In a Grain of Sand, which I like, it's a cosmic poem of mine. We closed the book with that so we could see that we get out of the ghetto and into the universe, the cosmology of people. These are the things that go on Earth, but we're just minusculely part of something greater. And that you can rise from the ghetto to get that kind of consciousness.
Heyo was recently presented in a theatrical form by Puerto Rican Traveling Theater and Pregones, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the process that made that come about, partially because the production itself is extremely musical, and they didn't make a big deal of it, but you could actually see the musicians behind a little partition there while they were working.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Hank. That's like the presentations that they made of my poetry were like the most seven exciting days in my life. All those performances, you went, huh? I hardly remember what happened because it was so, you know, it just blew me away. And yeah, you know, I'll dwell on that because it's a process. Okay, to begin with, they honored me with a grant, the 2013-14 Master Artist, in my case, Poet Playwright, because I've written plays before. My play was The Junkies Stole the Clock. It was produced in 1972 by Joe Papp at the Public Theater. It actually preceded the forming of the New Yorican Poets Playwrights Unit, but it eventually was part of that. And that ran for 10 performances. It was the very first play produced like that. And I wrote that play when I was about 21. And again, it's basically the autobiography of me and my dad and his struggle with drug addiction and the influence. It's just, it's a made-up story, but all those realities are in it. And also, you know, during the 60s, a lot of us died as a result of drug addiction and all of that. So we did that play at the Public Theater. Hey Yo, in fact, even The Junkie Stole the Clock has poems that are in the Hey Yo collection, because I like to put poetry in my plays, kind of like a Shakespearean attitude I have about it. Somebody breaks into a poem, you know?
See that in the work of a lot of playwrights, particularly people who do both, and I'm thinking specifically Sonia Sanchez and Baraka, where even if they don't go into actual poetry, the language itself has a very poetic sensibility.
And it also has the rhythm.
Well, yeah, like in The Junkie Stole the Clock, the story is being told by this character, Chino, who's a poet and a junkie. And they're all teenagers, you know, they're like 18, 19, so forth like that. So all of that, you know, yeah. So what happened was is that they gave me this grant and they just asked me to give them a bunch of poems. They already had the book, which has 60 poems in them, and they translated into Spanish. So that's 120 poems. And then I gave them like, I don't know, 70 more or something like that. And yeah, they had their work cut out for them. So Rosalba Rolón, who directed the production, she read this stuff through the summer. We've been working on this for about 8 months because they gave me the grant in August and the production just finished in April. And their intent was just to give me a night of poetry where, you know, they would make a presentation, the actors would be on book, and they would, that would be it. Then they would work on what they had and later on, maybe in the fall, do something as they did. But they tell me that when they were presented with my work, they cut to the chase and they wanted to do what they did. And I'm really proud and happy and humbled that the actors really liked my work and they saw theater in it. And I thought that what they did was extraordinary.
Now they scaled it down to 12 poems.
Because they produced that in like 18 days, I think. And what they did was they basically created the dramas that are within the stories of the poems. So they personified the poems as theater actors, as an ensemble. Then they added music, as you say, right? And there's a lot of music. So the audience can visually see the poem, but they're not changing a single word of the text. They're not altering one word. If they are, it's like an error, you know what I mean? But they're not.
Actually, they made a point of announcing that before the production began. That
yeah, that was
your text.
So incredible. Yeah, that was so incredible. So when they turned one of my poems into a full-fledged song, Bohemian in Love, which I'm in love with.
Is that the one with the doo-wop?
Yep. That's Bohemian in Love, which is a love poem that I wrote for a girlfriend who we only met twice, 30 years apart. And so that's why the poem is kind of circular. I submitted it because, you know, when I submitted the poems, I gave them a little flash drive, and I had, it says Pregones poems, and there are folders in them. In each folder, love poems, family poems, long poems, you know, like each this little folder for everything. And so, because if not, then you'd be lost because the poems go all over the place. And my understanding is that they love the work and they want to keep doing it.
Actually, I was wondering about whether they were going to build on that.
They probably are. I want to let them do their own things, stay out of the way as much as possible, stay out of my own way as much as possible, and let this thing happen. They're capable of doing what they do. You know, I'll stick in my opinion when, you know, I do have an opinion every now and then about something, and I have a theater history, so yeah, you know. But my suggestions would only be probably instigated from something they did that I saw and said, well, what about this too, or whatever, you know what I mean? I don't have any preconceived notions of how anything should be done. I'm glad for what they did and humbled. And I think everybody should see, no matter what, you know, one of the actors told me what I like about Papa is that he writes about other people. And I'd like that as a compliment, you know, because I think that, to me, poetry is always about empathy. And the height of compliment is for somebody to tell you, I have felt like that. To me, that's the height of compliment, because then you've done what poetry as a form of expression is designed to do, and that is to connect people with the commonality of humanity through empathy. Any poem that you look at is always about empathy, even if it's a self-deluded poem. Casey at the Bat, that's the quintessential empathetic poem. Mm-hmm. We don't want Casey to strike out.
Al Davis walked off the stage, that's what the folks are all saying. Yes, he did leave the stage, and as the solo was over, Coltrane, he walked off the stage, that's what the folks are all saying. Yes, they both left the stage, clean out of sight now. They felt they had to rehearse, although we know they are masters. They get a real groovy sound, and you will have to admit it. But yes, they both left the stage, soon as their solos were over. And if you can't figure out their groove, I'd like to hip you. Well, my friends, how about Miles Davis? I never know why some people always try to find some fault of this man every time. And when they go to wherever he is playing, they seem to go to see whether he is going to tend to business. Grab, bab, boo, ba, doo, doo, ba, doo, shoot, doo, doo, grab, fiddly, bop, bop, dee, ah.
never walks around the place and speaks to all of the folks he don't know. I wouldn't either, and neither would you, friend. But I know he is friendly. I do, the rest of us, we do. Oh, yeah. We dig his beautiful soul, and we love him and his blue heart. And here's another thing now about the clothes he wears. I'm sure his style is in the future. He is cool, the fit of his clothes are perfect. Just like the way he plays, he's not afraid of being different. And he has one more hope, just modern jazz. He and Gillespie are king. Out in his group are breaking records. Yeah, because it's yours. Walked off the stage, that's what the folks are all saying. Oh yes, he did leave the stage soon as the solo was over. Coltrane, he walked off the stage, that's what the people are saying. Oh yes, they both left the stage clean out of sight. Now they said they have to rehearse, although we know they are masters. They get a real mellow sound. You will have to admit it, but yet they both left the stage soon as the solos were over. And if you can figure out their group, well, I have helped you. Yes, they both left the stage. So what?
So is there a plan to bring the Junkie Stole the Clock back, or you've just moved on from that?
Well, you know, I always liked that play, but it went through permutations, you know. See, because, you know, the writer sits at home and thinks of something conceivable. Then when you involve other people, a lot of changes happen and so forth, and it develops. And I think that the Junkie Stole the Clock could be a play. But I think it should probably be a noir film.
You actually mentioned the possibility of making it into a film in an interview in Hey Yo Yo Soy. So I was wondering, one, how the process is going with that, or two, even how the process is bringing it back to the stage, because you didn't go into a lot of detail, but you did talk about some of the difficulties and maybe we can say disappointments in terms of its theatrical run.
Well, yeah, it only had 10 performances, and they were all full. People came to see the play, even in the rain. You understand, this is an era when there was hardly any Latino theater. Now, a lot of actors, you know, say, well, wait a minute, and they're right. We have an illustrious theater history in New York City with all the damn ethnicities. There's Yiddish theater that has a profound history here. There's black theater, you know, that has even Japanese theater, you know, so Latinos too. And when Miriam Colon and all those actors came from Puerto Rico to be here, Raul Julia and all them people, they wanted to do theater in English. You know, they did theater in Spanish, you know, you had Talia and all these other things, and Ayati and all these theaters, and the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater, they did theater in Spanish, you know, but the thing was to cross over. And that's why you have all these actors and everything, you know what I mean? You could see the result of it, but these are things that start from a hard place. there's a breaking through that has to occur. And still, there's a lot of breakthroughs that still have to go on. So back in the day when we were doing Junkies and stuff like that, we're still, I don't know if I'm going to use the word primitive, but you have to look at it like it was like a primitive state.
Well, it was formative.
Okay, formative. Okay, yeah, you know, we were trying to get our hands in the genre. When people say, well, what about the poets? I say, you know, we were trying to be poets. You know, people were saying you can't be a poet. We were trying to be poets. That's why I don't understand why people don't want to be poets now. They want to be something else, but use poetry. You see what I'm saying?
Well, even for you, it was a process to accept that you were a poet. I understood a teacher actually enlightened you on the concept.
Yeah, because I thought it was far-fetched. I mean, you know, it's kind of egotistical to think that you can just do something that even you admire. There's a difference between seeing something saying, oh, I can do that, and one where you organically get engaged in it and then discover that you're doing it. But right now, we're gonna see if Hey Yo, Yo Soy, the play, which includes poems from the book Hey Yo, I gotta mention this, all the poems in the play are not from the book itself. It's garnered that title Hey Yo because the poem itself is in the play, and it's a good working title. It's something that I've managed to brand with Thule Press helping along with the publication of the book, which was a big deal. I should mention Gabriel David, who started Thule Press with me on a handshake to publish Hey Yo, Yo Soy, and now there's a whole slew of writers, including Abiodun.
Abiodun Oyewole of The Last Poet's fame.
Right, and Tony Medina and Samuel Diaz, who was involved. Just a bunch of writers that wouldn't otherwise, or it's just a new organization. I mean, me, I didn't have a book out for the longest. So putting my three books together, those poems that were written over 40 years ago, it's not that this is the span of 40 years' work. This is work that was published over 40 years ago. So they were written much longer than that. You know, that, you know, some of them I was 15, 16 years old. Now in the theatrical production of Hey Yo, there were newer poems. For instance, Bohemian in Love. That poem was just written a few years ago. What Love Kills, which is the one that has like this kind of Bertolt Brecht, Kurt Vile piece where the woman's drenched in red.
Oh, and it has a Lo Scandalo.
Yeah, Scandalo, yeah. Now that was great because I always saw that piece as operatic in my head. I mean, strict opera, you know, you may as well have a damn spear. You know what I mean? I started like, he killed her! He killed her! You know, like that.
Killed a rabbit.
You know, yeah, but they went off into this whole other tangent, which was beautiful. They decided to mock sensational TV. Right. They got up there and created this whole thing. Well, they divided the poem into 2.5 parts, I would say, you know, and the whole cast got involved, so they make up this, locutor, you know, commentator, blah, blah. And then they throw the main story down on the floor of the stage, right at the steps, and this woman's drenched in a red, deep red light where she can tell the story of the poem. It's great. And also the doo-wop of Bohemian in Love, the whole sequence at the beginning where they do the haiku poem. That poem has 17 syllables, and I call it the longest haiku in the world. Because, right, the sequence of wind is about 20 minutes long, and it's just a haiku being repeated in different permeations of itself, and it's just lovely. It almost sounds like flowers blossoming.
Folks, I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Yes, I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Folks, I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Yes, I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. Thanks for Coleman Hawkins, he started a thing. Thanks for President Herschel, sure knew how to swing. Thanks for John Gillespie and for Newman too.
sun is setting moody. Certainly set a groove. And then I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. I surely want to thank you for letting me be myself again.
Could you talk a little bit about your involvement with the Nuyorican cultural movement?
Well, you know, I guess it's like lightning, you know. You're lucky to be somewhere at some time. When I was growing up, the majority of my friends were born in the 40s. I was always like the little guy, like the runt, figuratively and metaphorically. And so they were all born in the 40s, 44, 46, 49. And I had just missed the 40s. You know, I was born in the middle of 1950. I was so upset when I found out that all my friends, you know, I wanted to be part of that clique. However, I was part of the clique, except I was just the youngest one, you know. So as time progressed, I found myself kind of like in the right place at a lot of times. But I was always doing my thing. I was always interested in the arts. And see, now I think that now young people get involved in the arts, and they're more self-aware of their involvement in the arts, as I was. You know, and I got a casual thing about it, but yet I was involved in it. And it was different than other kids who were out playing basketball and baseball and things like that. So everybody that started writing, as I did, or through their own methodology that got them to pick up a pen and express what was going on, we were all kind of working in our own little vacuum. Not many people knew each other. Certainly I didn't read a lot, so I didn't know anything that was going on. I was just writing poetry and going to school. But things were happening. You know, it was 1968. There's a civil rights movement. There's a lot of stuff, a cacophony of social behavior going on. And so you got to get affected or really be disaffected. You know what I mean? Because there were people that didn't give a damn, you know, about the war. But slowly, you know, things start, you're writing. And we had doo-wop groups, too. You know, we would pantomime, singing little Anthony songs and stuff like that, and the Temptations and the Isley Brothers and everything. And I was writing since I was a little kid. So all of this is all, you know, mixed up into itself. Because of that, you start meeting different people and kind of like network before when you network. So, you know, you find yourself on the quadrangle of Fieldston Upper Bound program up in Fieldston, Riverdale, New York. reading poetry to your friends, and they got poetry too. You know, I guess young people still do that, but I don't know if it's poetry or it's spoken words that might have evolved. You know, but we're writing poems, you know, as we understand the structure of poetry. We're not necessarily deviating away from it, except for what we're talking about. Poetry, largely, some people say, oh, it's always about how lovely the curtains look fluttering into the room. You know, that stereotype of poetry, where poetry is that, but much, much more.
Time-wise, you're also coming up in an era where you have Baraka, and that is Amiri Baraka and people like that, talking about we really need to make poems that do something. I mean, in his words, poems that kill.
Right. So, you know, all of that is happening and people are getting affected when, and then you start meeting people, you know, so the Village was the place to meet other poets.
How'd you wind up down there?
Well, the Village, you know, I'm adventurous. I get on a train and wind up somewhere, you know, so and my brother was gay and he was a clothing designer, you know, and sometimes I'd hang out with him and, you know, discover Washington Square Park, you know, and stuff like that. And I had like this road map in my head, you know, like once I found a place, I know how to get there.
So your friends from where you were reading poetry somewhere else, you all wound up going to the Village? How'd that happen?
My big epiphany was my friends invited me to a jazz club. Well, it was some dive restaurant on 96th Street, the Inner Sunset. And I went down there, and I was very reluctant to go because, you know, I just didn't know, you know. So I took my poetry, which was just two little books that I would carry in my field jacket pocket, and I started reading my poetry. I was having a bad experience because I thought people weren't listening, they were eating, and I was like, oh, why am I doing this, you know. So then finally, and this goes making poetry do stuff, because I didn't know what to read. I'm just reading my poetry. I come out and I find Message to Urban Sightseers, which I had written just shortly before, and I had never read it in public. But I had experimented with capital letters and to see what that does. So I get to the point where I'm all upset with the audience, you know, not really mad at them, but just like bewildered and everything. And I don't know. So I see the words, hey, you. You know, I go, whoa. So they kind of shoot themselves through me, and I just get all animated in my reading, you know, and it was published in Street Poetry and Other Poems. Message to Urban Sightseers is the main poem, and the book should probably open up to
it. Because that's how it all happens. It's magical. You know, through that page.
Yeah, well, actually, in my regular book, in the book that this comes from, yes, it does, and my thumbprint is in the well of the book because over 30 years of holding it, I don't take that book out anymore. So this is just a portion of Message to Urban Sightseers. Hey you, sightseer, from small town nowhere U.S. of A., bring your head down, your eyes off those tall business buildings. Look at here, sightseer, sightseer, I'm a sight to be seen by your sore eyes. Sure, I'll be your guide. Want to send a friend a picture postcard? Here, take this one. That's me, my brothers, my mother, my father, my aunt, my uncle, my sisters, our cousins, and our dog. We all live very near one another, the same apartment. So that's an excerpt of that. And then it's written in my style of cascadence. It wasn't originally, but then I was able to fool around with it. And my cascadence, I called this, where the words cascade down the page. You can see it best in Hey Yo. See, Hey Yo's a good example, because that's it developed 40 years later.
tell you what's been going on. First off, this is Joyce Jones. And I, in addition to my associate producer, Hank Williams, the Sugar in My Bowl associate producer, are having a conversation with Jesus Papaleto Melendez. Okay. And what we're listening to right now is Take 5. This is the Brubeck Brothers Quartet. There's Dave Brubeck's sons. That drummer is Dan Brubeck. And Chris Brubeck, brother Brubeck, is on electric bass, bass trombone on some cuts. Mike D'Amico is on guitar, and Chuck Lamb is on piano. And this is a 2012 Blue Forest Records release. And let's see, before that we heard... All right, what did I type here? Or scribble here. Before that we heard Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself. And that was courtesy of Jesus Papaleto Melendez. He shared his Eddie Jefferson recordings with us. That's from Vocalese. Now, we will explain, or Eddie Jefferson, or the connection between Jesus Papaleto Melendez and Eddie Jefferson will be explained in the second hour. See, before that we heard, let's see, we heard So What, and that was, actually, let me tell you exactly what, because I think I skipped something here. Vocalese, come on, was, what is it? Oh, it says it was originally recorded in 1974, and the release date is a 1999, and it is on the, what sort of question mark label was that on? Gosh, yeah, so give me a second and I'll tell you. But before that, we did hear So What from Body and Soul. And that is an original classics label release. Before that, we heard, let's see, where are we? Letter from Home. Yes, that was another Eddie Jefferson, the title cut from his release, Letters from Home. Letter from Home. Letters from Home is from Pat Metheny. Letter from Home. Before that, we heard Ana Caona in tribute to Cheo Feliciano. And I've always liked that song. And I used to hear that song on WBLS when they used to play music like that. And all kinds of music. So that sort of harkened me back. And rest in peace, Cheo Feliciano. Before that, we had the theme, Sugar in My Bowl. I want a little sugar in my bowl, Nina Simone. And that is a BMG Records... Oh, records release. This is... Ana Caona is actually from a compilation. You may not be able to find it anymore because I had a hard time finding the other volumes. But this is volume 2 of Fania Plantino. And it's Constellation de Estrellas. So it's it was Fania Plantino Volume 2, and that was Ana Caona. That's where Ana Caona resides. Stay tuned for more Jesus Papaleto Melendez and the Brubeck Brothers, or the Brubeck Brothers Quartet. Right after this, we'll be on the bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams, and we'll continue to have more conversations. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for April 20th. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. You can catch this week's guest, poet Jesus Papaleto Melendez, on Wednesday, April 23rd. He'll be one of many poets and musicians appearing at a celebration for poet Steve Cannon. Event info is at tribes.org, that's tribes with an S, .org, and we'll post updates of future events here and on our blog. We've got some expanded listings for you this week to take you through the end of the month. We start with vocalist Catherine Russell, who will be performing the music of George Gershwin at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Allen Room on the 23rd and 24th. Go to jalc.org for details. Saxophonist Gary Bartz leads a quartet at the reopened Minton's on the 30th. See Minton's with an S, harlem.org for details on their show. That's Minton's with an S, harlem.org. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts appears at Western Connecticut State University on the 25th and 26th, leading a quartet and the Village Vanguard Big Band. Details are at wcsu.edu and look for the events section. Several Sugar guests will be appearing at the Guggenheim Museum as Carrie Mae Weems has events on the 25th to the 27th, including poet and singer Carl Hancock Rux, trombonist Craig Harris, and Dick Griffin. The Guggenheim's website has all your details. Go to guggenheim.org for information. Looking further ahead, blues woman Alexis P. Suter opens for Johnny Winter at the B.B. King Blues Club on April 29th. See bbkingblues.com. Looking much further ahead, organist John Medeski will be at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, with The Word on May Day, May 1st. Go to thecapitoltheater.com for details. Also on May Day, pianist Vijay Iyer will be at the 92nd Street Y with the Brentano String Quartet. Go to 92y.org for details. And lastly, a reminder that the Central Brooklyn Jazz Consortium's annual festival runs for the rest of the month. Details are at their website, which is the full name, centralbrooklynjazzconsortium.org. That's all for this week. If you miss anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2wbai.org, or you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We're off the air next week for the last Sunday of the month, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, May 4th. Either way you connect, we'll see you then on the bandstand.
Thank you so much, Hank Williams, for On the Bandstand. And, check out our blog if you didn't catch everything that was shared. At sugarinmybowl.org. Just look for the tab for the blog, and you can get information that you may have missed, especially information about this Wednesday's fundraiser for Steve Cannon, where Jesus Papaleto Melendez will be. Stay tuned.
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, the best radio station. you'll ever hear.
So can you read that?
You know, okay, he was, well, not all of it, okay, just
okay, about part. That's it, right?
No, he was like 3 pages.
Oops, okay.
I'll just start at the beginning. You know, but one thing I say about Heyo, when they do it in the play, they break it up into a whole lot of pieces. And, you know, I really like that. It has a different kind of musical beats. But I like the part when Flaco Navaja comes downstage and then just breaks it down to the audience. I'll read that part after I read the beginning of the poem. Hey, yo, yo, yo. Hey, yo, 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 yo. Hey, yo, 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 yo. Hey, yo, yo soy Puerto Ricano, bro. That's right, S.A. That's what I say, jefe. Que I, too, am puro puto único. Unico essay, just like you, like you, just like you. Que I am me, que I am you, as you and me, que hey, yo, yo, yo soy Puerto Ricano, bro. Que it is a we thing, it is an I see thing, a whole huge nosotros trip that governs this ship. El planeta Earth that gives us birth in multicolors of the universe. And everything that I be, you be too. También se dice así ese. So then it goes on and on and on. You know, because why? And then he breaks it down. This thing, racism, isn't a natural schism that makes you part of a system that puts you in this prison for almost no reason, that allows for killing your own, essay. Or that allows for killing your own.
Fantastic.
So lo vamos a hacer aquí, lo vamos a tirar así, okay? Hey, yo! Hey, yo! 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 Puertorriqueño, bro. That's right, ese. That's what I say, ese. I, too, am puro, puto, único. Unico, ese. Just like you. Like you, just like you. Que I am me. Que I am you. As you and me, que hey, yo, yo soy Puerto Ricano, bro. Que it is a we thing, it is an I see thing, a whole huge nosotros trick that governs this shit, el planeta Earth. It gives us birth in multicolors of the universe. And everything that I be, you be too. También se dice así, ese. Because why? Violado por un antichorro español de
therefore Latinos, therefore why? My hair blows so, bro. Comprendez-vous what I'm telling you? Que soy a modern Latin from a barrio Manhattan. This thing, racism, isn't a natural schism. That makes you part of a system. That puts you in this prison, almost for no reason. That allows for killing your own brother, F.A. That allows for killing your own brother, F.A. This is the season. This is the season. Chris O'Connor, who would come? You would kill your own brother instead. Este ahí, este ahí, este ahí, comprende mí. Este ahí, este ahí.
Jesús Papoleto Melendez, thank you. That was really very, very nice. One more.
You were on with Felipe.
No. This is his ex-wife's show.
Oh, Nancy Rodriguez.
Right.
I love that. I can't believe I can't remember what it is that I miss her. Nancy Rodriguez. Yeah.
Ritmo con H. That
was the name of her show.
Oh. And it was, I think, during the week that the BAI is trying to get money and all that.
Oh, it was a fundraising. Okay.
Right. So she invited a bunch of musicians to the studio, and then she invited a bunch of poets. And so what I did was, you know, she allowed me to hit with this band. And so we just did it. We just did it right off the cuff. There was no rehearsing. And I just tell them, do this and let's go for it. And we did. So that's that recording.
Eddie Jefferson. You pointed out that okay. Eddie Jefferson was...
Yes, I have my Eddie Jefferson here. Have you ever heard Eddie Jefferson do Bitches Brew? This is going to blow your mind. There's lyrics to Bitches Brew.
Green snake eyes and one big foot good. What? Frog legs, roots and herbs. Mean old woman mixing up our bitches brew now. Show you strength.
jammed up on a told you so.
Yeah.
Dig it? Mean little woman mixing up an evil brew now.
Man did a sister wrong. Some man did a sister wrong. Her mind has gone from the case. Her brain is now such a waste. Some man did a woman wrong. Now she wants to rip us off. The hate, it grows like an itch. She's sick, she's sad. What a bitch. Maybe one day she will meet a real fine man. Treat her sweet. Will not forget. Wish no more. She will not be a witch no more. Won't not make a picture through. Won't have to make a picture through.
Away from my high, the bitches through. Run away from my high, it'll get you, the bitches through. Run away from my high, it'll get you, the bitches through. The bitches bruise. Run away, going high, it'll get you. The bitches bruise. joyous dreams like a witch. The bitch of room will get to you.
So Eddie Jefferson, he was inspirational to you, or what's up?
Yeah, you know, but later on, I mean, like, I didn't meet Eddie Jefferson until, like, the 80s.
His music.
Yeah. And then I was impressed, you know, by the vocalese. I mean, we all heard There I Go, you know, Moody's Blues.
Moody's Move for Love.
That's his song. I mean, King Pleasure did it as well, another version. But I like Eddie's because Eddie does both voices. He does the woman's
voice.
Yeah.
And oh, baby, please.
He's, like, so great. And all the other jazz standards that he does, you know, Now's the Time and So What and all of the. So when I heard that, like, that had an impact on me because I had been trying to do stuff with my poetry like that has a rhythm. So he just basically justified for me that, you know, that can happen. You know, when we started branching out and meeting each other, we all gravitated somehow to the Village, because the Village was the place where different things were happening. People that thought differently were collecting. So that's how I met all the other poets, you know, just by hanging out and spreading out.
So we talked a little bit about the Nuyorican movement and your involvement in that. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about the relationship or possibly inspiration of the Black Arts and Black Power movement on your work and your involvement.
You know, we lost Amiri Baraka recently. And, you know, we've been losing a lot of special people recently. But most recently, Amiri at the beginning of the year. And, you know, I've known Amiri since I was about 19. And, you know, we didn't hang out all the damn time, but we hung out. And when we hung out, you know, heavy at his house. Pedro Pietri and myself and would go over there to he and Amina's house. And they had those Saturday night special things and that where everybody came. And I wrote about that, incidentally, in a poem that I wrote for Miri's birthday. So it goes like this. To say happy birthday is to say I love you. As comes from everyone who utters happy birthday to you today. In appreciation of you, for you, being you in this world, sharing yourself, a spiritual being, being in a human experience, experiencing life from a poet's point of view. Thus you, camouflaged in the hue of ebony, in your own mystery that ebbs and flows with time and space, encircled in a galaxy of immediate urgency, placed here with antenna tuned to the political hypocritical frequency of social inequality, to profess in the prophecy of poetry. Oh, and what a life that be, that led poets like Sandra Maria Esteves and me to ride down to Washington, D.C., to hear some poetry to a group of teens who, in their wisdom, were keen to your wisdom in a damp and chilly church community center basement / creative writing workshop type setting. Oh, were they not then among us hipsters on those unforgettable Saturday night special poetry readings at you and Amina's in Newark, the late Reverendo Pedro and the great Hilton Ruiz accompanying each other and me on conga and piano respectively, though Pedro was something like way off key, three drunks as drunk as three drunks can be, Hilton looking up from his mad groove on the black and ivory keys, checking out these madder cats wailing poetry like we were all crazy, and yes we were, with all the other would-be poets and musicians, artists, painters and sculptors, pretenders and hustlers, all with their lovers, all lovers of poetry, and their children, if they had them, there with them too, running around the house, in and out of rooms, speaking of Michelangelo and Thelonious Monk, jazz and the singing of blues, and the music of poetry running amok, flowing like wine, grapes of wrath and laughter spilling over from plastic cups, the smell of high-priced perfume and sweat, and listening to and fro and networking before there was surfing and there was no text messaging, instead interesting poetic ideas, flesh to flesh, eyeball to eyeball, racing through like some sweet bird of youth, unaware of its beauty, unassuming in grace. beatniks and postmodern dudes, black militants and radicals of a mathematical persuasion, activists, all commies, socialists, data surrealists, freedom fighting wordsmiths, blessed with the gift to talk to a mountain of the hip, the hop, spoken word or spinning rhyme, must pay some props to the griot rapper, the sage upon the stage, who speaks with or without the written page, but nevertheless whose rage can be placed to a specific place and time, all the cause of blood that's flowed past time. Militant fire and brimstone issuing forth from this brother's big mouth to talk about the culture that he helped cultivate, through which now the youth of today has something to say. So to you, our brother and sacred sage, master piecer of the white blank page, having lived to such a ripe, well-rounded age, and are a legendary legend, currently living among the living, and working on a novel life of poetry as a poet most notably, so thus it be said and thus it be heard. Poet master, master poet sir, undisputed poet laureate of Newark and the mental state of Nueva Jersey for life. Happy birthday, bro. Word up. That's the movie's birthday poem.
Excellent.
So, yes, yeah, so you can see the influence. I guess it's encapsulated in that poem. You know, I was fortunate. I knew a lot of great people in my life. Piri Thomas, Tato Laviera, Sandra Meyers Perez, June Jordan, Audre Lorde, and Tazaki Shange. We used to hang out here and on the West Coast. So all of this is all happening, and you know, that's why we're elders now. We all know each other, you know, walk around and with all these hugs and kisses and everything. It all feels good. It's something to have been involved in something for so many years. I mean, I still feel young and cool and all that, but you know, man, I walk around with a cane nevertheless. And, but we've been around a long time, and we are the history of this, and we're not passé, none of us. You know, like, see, I think that the whole argument of generationalism, people are forgetting that there is a conspiracy to keep us from ourselves in this society. And they'll do anything. I got to say this. What happens is that the government learned from the 60s that you cannot let youth get too damn radicalized. You know, that's why, you know, they started sending their kids to college. They always send their kids. Then they put us in college into the mix. And, you know, through open admissions and everything like that. And, you know, we didn't corrupt your damn youth. Your youth was reading stuff that corrupted them. You know, they started looking at the news and figuring stuff out about the war and blah, blah, blah. You know, and actually that's been a history of this country. There's certain factions that disagree with what's going on. There was a whole white faction that hated slavery. But you need that coalition of other people that are outside what's happening with you to make things happen. So you can't let a youth today fool around with high technology and radicalize themselves, because the internet is already top of a few governments. That can happen here. So what you're getting is a dumbing down. So most people that are fooling around with the technology are just playing games. That's why, look at what spoken word has become on the radio or whatever. What are they, you know what I'm saying?
It's, well, actually, you made a comment about when you said it, in your thinking, that it seems as though there's a difference between spoken word and poetry. Could you verbalize that?
Well, it's very complicated because, you know, I'm for self-expression, but I believe in the responsibility of self-expression because there's too much at stake. I mean, anybody can be frivolous. You can be frivolous about any old damn thing. You can be frivolous in a relationship, and then you'll see what will happen there. It'll just fall apart. We live in serious times. Maybe it's because I'm older. Even when I was younger and we were doing what we were doing, we're still serious about it and we're doing something. Not that young people aren't. I'm arguing about the so-called generational divide. And that divide is expressed between that division of poetry and spoken word. Why is spoken word something that's derivative from poetry? Obviously, you could tell by its syntax and blah, blah. It seems like it's like interchangeable. If it's convenient to be this at some time, then that's what we are. And if it's convenient to be this, then that's what we are. See, I'm never a spoken word artist. I'm a poet. And when I read my poetry to you, I'm performing it, but I'm basically reading it. You say it's there on the page. I'm not doing anything that isn't there. See, and I believe in writing. And even spoken word artists have to write. So I'm not getting it. You see, I think that there's an allowance or an acceptance of that divide that I keep talking about. And I'm aware of the divide, so I'll mention it.
Well, in Hey Yo, there's a part where you talk about you feel that a lot of the art created today is disposable. And is that what you're getting at here in terms of not having perhaps a certain level of depth or maybe a certain amount of attention to craft, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Yeah, Hank, I think it is. Because sometimes I read stuff that I've seen performed. And it doesn't read well on the page because it's not developed for the page. It's developed for the ear. You see, now when I'm trying to write, I'm trying to develop things, and you can see in the earlier poems when I didn't know how to use commas or semicolons, then I created blank space. You see, that's how cascadence got, so that I could still create what I wanted, even though I didn't know the punctuation that was proper to use in that circumstance to create the same thing. But that created something else, something new. And that's okay because that's still in the lineage of literature. We're still writing down. See, when you play with your mind, in writing down your thoughts, you get more out of it than when you just talk out of your mouth. So even if you talk out of your mouth and you write that down, you're going to have to deal with it when you write it down. You know what I mean? Because there's always more stuff in what you say. You know when people say, oh, I didn't mean to say that. In other words, they didn't mean to give you that much information. It's like this country ended slavery and then enslaved the whole country. It says, okay, they're not going to work for free. We'll pay them, then we'll control that, and everybody will have chained. Everybody is economically chained or enslaved to the system, which the poem, The Pyramid, is all about. In Hey Yo, the play, there's a poem, Conversation with My Son, which is the one about the pyramid, one group of people holding up yet another group of people holding up yet another group of people. So, yeah, so I get angry because what I see is that a failure of political sophistication of young people writing. Like sometimes I call them cultural capitalists, where they'll go and capitalize on something like, oh, the ballad of the bullet, or by any means necessary, you know, by any means necessary, what? I'm going to tap that. So that's what I'm saying. You know, we don't need vulgarity. Life is vulgar enough. What we need is enlightenment. You know, if you're going to be out there, they were all in competition with each other. The only people that a lot of young people who are trying to aspire, and I'm not saying fall because I know some really down brothers. I'm not talking about them, brothers and sisters. I'm not talking about them because they're doing their thing and they know I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the idiots that go and insult us with their ignorance and are just out there to make some money for themselves because they have some charisma, some finesse, and so forth. And a lot of them are just incorrect with themselves, politically incorrect. Well, you know, you live in a society that's more concerned with you being vocally politically correct than actually politically correct.
I got a question. It says here, January 20th, 1980.
Yeah.
You were tired and decided to leave. What happened?
No, well, if you go back in the late 70s, that's January, that's 20 days into 1980. And New York was defaulting in the 70s, late 70s, early, was still in that stage. You know, people talk about the recession now. Well, we were talking about 1980, right? That was a bad time. And that's that time when you see all the graffiti on the trains and everything and the burnt buildings and the landlords are burning their buildings and everything. Well, this time right now, this so-called recession is worse than that. People are just holding it up better, but it's actually worse than that. I was like 29 years old then, and things weren't really working out for me here in New York. You know, I couldn't find a job, the schools, you know. It pretty much like it kind of is still, you know. I just have better things going on for me now, but nothing consistent. I still don't have a job, you know, where I can count on a paycheck every 2 weeks. But it was really, really hard, you know. Like, I was doing poetry readings, and I'd get paid $75, which is why I can't understand why somebody wants to give me $75 to do a poetry reading today. It's like there's no, what do you call it?
Rate of inflation.
Yeah, right. There's none in the arts. Like, gee whiz. But I just was having a hard time. I call it the period where my life had fallen down. And it was just a very hard time for me socially. Broke up with my girlfriend, everything. And so I left New York basically to rescue myself from dying here. And I did. New York didn't like that. Because when I came back to New York in 94, the first thing that happened was that I got arrested, which forced me to have to stay in New York in order to deal with the ramifications of being arrested by this racist cop, Douglas Gorman.
You wrote a piece about that, too. But before we talk about that, let's stay between that period of 1980 and 1984, where you eventually wound up being involved in Exile Genius. Tell me about Exile Genius.
Exile Genius was a group that I formed with Eugene Mingus and Umchaka Uba when we were all living in Tijuana, Mexico. I left New York in 1980. I took a Boeing 747, something like that, and it was the anniversary of them using them, so all the liquor was free. So the ride was like a half hour. So then I landed in L.A., and I opened up a map. I put a map right there, and I opened it up. I said, I'm just lost, man. I don't know where I'm at. I just see desert here. And so I jumped in the bus, Greyhound, went downtown. I remember I asked the bus driver, I said, do you stop near Skid Row? And he said, the bus stops right across the street. And he's right. It's not a nice neighborhood. The poem is named Ode to Skid Row. They had hired a security firm to keep the Gaslamp Quarter District, which was like an old district that looked like the Old West and stuff like that. And that's where all the artists lived, in the Gaslamp. They've gentrified it and everything. And what happened was is that one of the cops, Clancy was his name, and they were all dressed as Keystone Cops in that period piece, as hot as it was with those damn wool uniforms. And Clancy had a cattle prod, an electric cattle prod, and he would prod the homeless that slept on the chic benches that the city council had left scattered along the Gaslamp Quarter. They were old throwbacks. They were wood with a green painted wrought iron with curly cues, but the homeless would sleep on them. So to get them off, he would cattle prod them. So I wrote this poem to him. Cops be stopping dudes for spitting on their own beat shoes, for spitting against the wind as it blows in San Diego. I like this line, too.
Oh, the sun feels great against the skin. Oh, the clouds are cool and the breeze is green. Butterflies with short lives dance in the sky like painting pictures with their second five. This ain't no job. This all alive in sunny San Diego. This was going down all around this sunny, sleepy southern town.
And I lived in L.A. for a while, and L.A. was like New York spread out, hotter, miserable. You don't have a car, you're not going to get far. I hated L.A. L.A. is a terrible place to be broken, that's for sure. But some friends of mine encouraged me to go down to San Diego, so I went down there, and I kind of liked San Diego a lot better. It was slower, chill. Because L.A. reminds you of New York, but it's a bad attitude because it's very classist kind of city, and everybody's all materialistic, so if you ain't got nothing, you look like you ain't got nothing. But in San Diego, I was able to, like, find some settlement, you know, just be able to do something that was better for me. And I lived in San Diego, I had a life in San Diego for a while, but eventually I wound up moving to Mexico, just crossing the border to Tijuana. And that was a whole nother aspect, no, a whole other aspect of my life.
So when you went to Tijuana, is that where you met Eugene?
Yeah, now Eugene Mingus is the son of Charles, the jazz musician. Eugene himself plays great piano and bass. He's a really genius guy, really, really cool guy.
The third member, what did he play?
Chaka Ubas from Chicago, and he plays bass. And sometimes we get some side men like a to complete the trio. And they would create original tunes for my poems. So it would be the same tune for each poem. And we were working on that before I came back to New York in 94, and that's when I was arrested and beat up by the police and everything, so I never could get back to them, and we all lost touch with one another. And that's tragic, because wait till you hear what we did. We opened for the Urban Bushwoman. We opened for Tito Puente in San Diego. We were really happening, you know. We didn't rehearse a lot. It was really hard to keep the group together. But we called ourselves Exile Genius because all of us lived in Mexico. And we were like kind of like an exile from the U.S. And then somebody said, well, why you call yourself Genius? I said, well, why not? I'm not going to wait for nobody to claim me. I put that crown on my own damn head.
As you mentioned earlier, you came back to New York in 94 and was met with brutality.
There was a poetry reading at King Caliber Gallery over on 2nd and off of B, I think it is. And I was just going down there to read my poetry one Saturday night. I usually would dress up to go to a poetry reading. You know, I put on some slacks and a shirt. But since I was in New York, I decided to jean and t-shirt it, you know, kind of, you know, like, okay. And sometimes I think that was the error because I wasn't dressed the way I normally, you know, would do. After the reading, I'm standing on the corner of St. Mark's and I'm talking to somebody that my girlfriend knew from before she went out to California with me. And I hear somebody rolling up on us, like cursing and just foul mouth coming out of them. And they're talking about everybody got to get out of the way and move. And I'm like, what the? It was just so violent. Who the hell is it? So I turn around. Well, actually, I uttered, what the F is your problem? And I turn around and it's this damn cop. And that's his problem. His problem is that he's like exactly 3/4 of an inch taller than me. And I'm only 5'3". I said, gee, you know, because people say, oh, you're short. I go, I'm not short. I have a different perspective.
Well, you had locked hair at that time too, right?
Yeah, I had these dreadlocks. That's why it says the racist guy. So he approaches me from behind and he sees the dreadlocks and they're long. They're past my waist. And so he's uttering this stuff. Now he's breathing down my damn back, you know, and I didn't know he was a cop. You know, people say, well, was he in uniform? When you turned around and told him, I said, well, was he in uniform when he was talking like that? What the hell, you know? He was ready for me. He grabbed me and threw me against the door of some establishment and threw me on the ground and started to try to punch me in my face while I'm down there and he has me pinned, you know. I bit him in the knee, cried like a... He cried, you know? You know, and then the judge asked me, you know, why I bit him. And my lawyer said, well, what was his knee doing in my face? So, you know, let's deal with that question. But it took 2 damn years to get out of that. And I had 3 choices. I could acquiesce and probably do some stupid time, you know, whatever, you know. I could run away, just go back to my life, but then I have to cross the border. Or I could fight, which, you know, seems the best idea to do when somebody's trying to... But you see, I'm really upset about that and still remain upset about it because nobody did anything about it for me. Even people that who profess that that's what they do something about this. I couldn't find anybody to help me. And I looked, but I was weak, you know, because that really took me off my kilter. So the Papoleto who landed in New York never really got to be here because this guy threw me in a car, beat me up, involved me in the system. I'm not part of the system. I can befriend someone who's a police officer. You know? But as a group, I have no use for you guys. Sorry. Like my friends in the West Coast say, if you got a problem, you call the police, then you got 2 problems to deal with at least. You know?
And you added on at least.
Right. I added on at least to make it rhyme. Yeah. Artists are anarchists by nature, and many of them don't know it. because it is anarchy to wake up in the morning and go try to finish a painting that you were working on yesterday. That's anarchy. Because everybody else woke up, took a shower, and left and went to some job they had to go do. I believe it was Charles Mingus who wrote this poem for his wife, or vice versa. High in the sky. And Gene wrote this music for it. And then we segue a poem that I got called Poem for My Father into it. Well, I want to create, like, poetry videos. And there's, a lot of varieties of doing that. You could do it, like an MTV type thing, you know what I mean? But also, I create poetry scrolls. Since my poetry is very visual on the page, with the cadence and everything, I like people to see that, to visit that, to enjoy the poem that way. So what I developed was, I'll take a poem of mine, let's say it's a long poem, like about 6 regular pages, 8.5 by 11. And I'll go, okay, let me move it to 8.5 by 14 paper because they're longer. Or I make a long paper and then I lay the poem on a couple of sheets of it. And then I turn them into JPEGs. So the poem is divided into 2 or 3 of these long sheets and each one's a JPEG. And then what I do is I bring them into Final Cut Pro as JPEGs and I just line them up one behind the other. And so now they're one thing. Then using the Ken Burns, you can get them to scroll. And then I voice over them so that as I'm reading them, you're visiting the poems like a player piano. Basically, you see how the poem moves. This is a poem called Cat. This is Brother Rahim mixed for me. He gave me a beat. And so I do the poem to just kind of like a hip-hop beat. But it came out really good. I call it Cat, but it's actually Mother of the Year. C-A-T, Mother of the Year. Cat.
How do you get Cat out of Mother of the Year?
Because it's a poem about, it's this cat, she died recently. This cat was pregnant and had 5 kittens, and there was a fire in the building. And the fireman came to put the fire out, but the cat rescued her own litter. And that's what the poem is about. So she became the Mother of the Year.
Is that the plan on your website? Once you finish the videos, you're going to put them on your website?
Yeah, I want to put them up because I think it's a way to experience the poems, It's fun. I like to take images and put them behind the poem.
Background pattern.
Yeah.
What is your website?
Papoleto.com.
It's a good thing it was available, too.
Because I don't want nobody to take that,
So I have like a list of folks, and when I say their name, I want you to share your thoughts about them. Sandra Maria Estevez.
Well, Sandy's a great writer, and she should be respected for all the work that she did in laying groundwork for other women poets, especially for other Puerto Rican women poets in the diaspora of the New Rican Poets Movement. She was there. She did the work. She hung out. She paid the dues.
Luis Reyes Rivera.
Well, Luis was the diaspora bridge that a lot of people begrudge him and hold against him. But, he was very aware of our African roots, and he connected with them and connected with the African-American community here very strongly, to the point of I turned and told somebody when we went to his funeral in Brooklyn, the low percentage of Puerto Ricans who had showed up, we were outnumbered by every other race there celebrating. Luis was a great poet. Great humanitarian, beautiful person. The picture of he and I in Hey Yo was taken 3 weeks prior to his passing. And he suggested that we take that picture, I remember. Because that was very out of his character to suggest, let's take a picture together. I was like, okay, but it was a fine suggestion.
Miguel Pinheiro.
Miguel's a tragic story. He wrote some, it was pretty good, it came from his heart and soul, and, he had the legacy that he wrote for himself, so I'm gonna say.
Pedro Pietri.
Pedro was my great friend, and if you saw the play, there's a poem called Cosmic Cosmonauts, and that's dedicated to Pedro. It's a poem about just our friendship. And in fact, I have a couple of poems about Pedro, 2 or 3 of them. And Pedro has a couple that he wrote for me. So, Pedro died basically in my arms. I was holding his hand in the plane when he died, and his head was in his brother's lap. And it was a very surreal moment when he passed away in the plane over Roswell, New Mexico. And just to keep the stuff going. Pedro was a great poet. He was like, our Shakespeare. And his poetry has a long legacy that right now, we don't know what's up, but it will survive anything that's going on. People should read Pedro. I get very heartbroken when I mention Pedro. I say, you know, sometimes I just say Pedro, expecting you to know who I'm talking about. Because if somebody said Papo, I would expect you to know that they're talking about me. They don't know who I'm talking about. And I say, Pietri, you know, this guy died last week. I know it was 10 years ago, and it has been 10 years. But that's last week, you know, and here you are, you don't know who that is, and you say you're a writer or whatever, back to the cultural capitalism and all that, you know, it's like, hey. So the thing is that I've known a lot of great people, you know, I saw the best minds of my generation, and I hung out with them. They were really great people that you're never going to know except through what they left behind, and they paved the road for everything that's happening. You know, we have a female Puerto Rican city council member who's now, you know, the speaker of the city council.
Melissa Mark Viverito.
Right. And, you know, you take a person like that, I mean, you know, that's an achievement. You know, that's something to admire, you know, somehow, you know, even for a person as jaded as me. But I understand that achievement like that is not alone. She didn't do that. You are walking down a path that's been paved for you. Prior to then, there was boulders, you know, salamanders, snakes, and everything else, you know, in the path. And it was paid for you. Not that you didn't have to work for it. You did, you know. But just as an example like that. And these people like Pedro, the people you mentioned here, you know, Miguel Agarin, you know, Miguel Piñero, all those people did something of a cultural nature. And they practically did it for nothing, you know, not even for gratification. They just did it because it was a mission. And they didn't get paid. They lost their lives. The price they paid was their lives. You see? So you have a responsibility to these people. I always say, you're either standing on the force of a diaspora or on a pile of bones.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. But I guess since we've been talking about it, what's the responsibility for us now in terms of what's been done and what do we owe you as artists?
Thank you. That's a great question. The thing is that our community has to be proactive about supporting the people that are artists in its community. It's like it's more expensive and more of a hardship to be an artist now than it ever was before, and it's always been that. You see, it's not like it's ever been easy. And this country only pays artists who make it. You see, because I'd say in this country there are only two kinds of citizens. There are workers and there are salesmen. There are people who gain celebrity to sell this country to the world. And basically it's, hi, you know me, I'm famous, buy this. That's what it's about. So either you're one of those guys or you schlepping a 9-to-5, whatever it is, trying to make a living. And even artists, you know, who are trying to don't make it there. Then you have people that do make it and don't look back. To me, life is a learning experience. And if you read, you know, my last poem on the grain of sand, which talks about that, you know, it's just for the purpose that we could see each other. You know, skin is for the purpose of the eyes so that we can actually see each other. I think that we're spiritual beings on a human mission, and that life is much more important than the file cabinet or anything else that's going on. You see, but we're failing that. Materialism is falling in love with the world and the things of the world. That's materialism. Spiritualism is seeing above that. I just think that our community really needs to support you. I mean, really, like we just had my play, and, you know, there were times that there wasn't a full house. That, you know, we could have seated another 20, 30 people there. Well, they should have been there. We have to be responsible for perpetrating our values. Otherwise, nobody else is going to do that, or our history, or our culture, or our language, or anything. So we have to do that, and we have to keep doing it and be diligent about it. While we're here, while we still exist, we need to support the arts. You know, like for me, it's hard to find a job. You know, I'm always penny pinching. I should have a gig teaching at some after-school program or something that supports me for 10 months out of the year, that doesn't stress me out, you know, just uses me 2 or 3 days a week, but it's enough salary. That's all we're asking for. Artists in this country are underused, and it's all to the detriment of humanity. And then rich, rich people. You have people that make millions of dollars exploiting the arts, and they don't come back. It's the last poem in the book. Has its own chapter, the epilogue. I wrote this poem in 2010. That's how recent it is. In a grain of sand, to see a world in a grain of sand, from Auguries of Innocence by William Blake. That's where the title of the poem comes from the first line of that poem. We are star seeds, every one of us. You and me and you, and him and her, and them and they, and those who know of this are truly blessed. True for all living beings, beings living, not humans only, but ants and trees and the open breeze, things that breathe, air or fire, water, earth, all kinds of dust and dirt, particles, a part of all a part of everything that isn't everything. Thus it sings, and its song is life, and life is a seed of stars, the dust of suns and moons, rocks and dust and outer smoke in outer space, floating in a bath of timelessness, counted, measured, numbered by some species others carry not. Science and mathematics trying to plot poetry in motion, motion in a helix's curve, and life on Earth becomes visible to you through the naked eye.
Thank you so much, Jesus Papaleto Melendez, for joining Sugar Mabo.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks again for coming.
Jesus Papaleto Melendez. Thank you so much, Papo, for all the time and knowledge and contributions. And yes, if you do get to get an opportunity, another opportunity to see Hey Yo, Yo Soy, you should do that. You should make sure you get in the seat. But this Wednesday, April 23rd at the New Eureka Poets Cafe, 236 East 3rd Street. There's the fundraiser for a celebration of a gathering of the tribes and an excellent, excellent Steve Cannon, Friends of Steve Cannon, an evening of poetry and jazz in a celebration of a gathering of the tribes. And you can find out more about that by going to tribes.org. Or to New Eurekan, N-U-Y-O-R-I-C-A-N, NewEurekan.org. And let's see, New Eurekan Poets Cafe is once again at 236 East 3rd Street, Pedro Pietri Way, between Avenues B and C. Coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. Stay tuned. This is WBAI. We will see you next month. The playlist is up on sugarmybowl.org. Stay tuned.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.